Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, on a very cold, windy Melbourne evening, Monday. Now, the astute observers amongst you will realize that I'm not Simon Margenson. Simon was to chair this session this evening. We're not too sure what's happened to him, but so I've been press ganged in to serve for Simon. My name's Lynn Meek, and I'm the director of the L.H. Martin Institute. Now, had Simon been here, you would be able to listen to his introduction for the next 20 minutes before we introduce the speakers. Now, since I'm here and I haven't had the opportunity to prepare anything or to fill Simon's role as introducing and setting the scene for it, we'll move straight in to our two speakers. We're very privileged tonight to have Michael Beaton Wells from the university, who's in the executive of the university and strategy and planning, and Martin Royden, who's the chief executive officer of TDA TAFE Directors Australia. And I think Michael, you're going to speak first, and the topic tonight is scrutiny and transparency: the new standards regime in tertiary education. Michael's going to, I think, speak for about 20 minutes or so, then Martin, and then we'll have plenty of time this evening for questions and answers. And I'll lead that as well if Simon doesn't show up by then. Okay, thank you very much. Over to you, Michael.
Thanks, Lynn. Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming to hear myself and Martin speak this evening. It's the 4th of July, and I'm not sure whether we're having fireworks to celebrate independence or the quality of debate tonight. So I thought that was just a bit ironic, really. We have a real moment in the history of Australian higher education happening right now. Through the development of the Tertiary Education Quality Standards Agency, the back-to-back arrangements, almost back-to-back arrangements with the VET regulator. There'll be a whole range of complex arrangements flowing back into states as a result of that, and certainly comprehensive arrangements for the first time nationally around the tertiary system generally in this country. We also have significant reform going on in a whole range of ways, touching almost every aspect of the system, from funding to quality to research evaluations, etc. So a very interesting time to be involved in higher education. I'm going to touch briefly on why this national standards framework has come about, and to briefly talk about TEXA. I think, although we all tend to leave to the lawyers' reading of legislation, I really do urge everyone here and your colleagues to go away and read the Tertiary Education Quality Standards Act. If you're going to be in tertiary education in this country, you need to understand the Act. It's a regulatory model. It's not soft quality assurance. So a huge part of what's coming, it's all defined in the Act. And then the Act is going to be interpreted by regulators and by public servants and officials and independent panels, etc. And so it all comes back to what's in that piece of legislation. And each piece of legislation is a unique creature. I think it's much more important to read that than it was to read the Higher Education Support Act, for example, which was a very dense machinery of funding and other schemes. The TEXA Act is a defining framework for the system. I will get onto the framework and then raise some key issues. So, why has a national standards framework come about? This list makes a series of propositions. In fact, it's drawn from the objects of the TEXA bill, And I've just reversed the order. So the bill is in the positive, saying we're doing this for national consistency, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm implying that all of these things must have been factually correct. I think, by and large, these things are qualitatively correct. We're moving in a positive direction on all of these factors. But it is worth thinking about the mixture of objects here. They range from the practicalities of doing business in Australia, trying to operate across the federation of states and territories is a pretty difficult business if you want to operate in all of them on the ground, as opposed to just recruiting students across the Murray River. And so there is a clear issue for any organisation wanting to do that, dealing with inconsistencies. There have been a number of failures, and some would say regulatory failures, others would simply say failures, of organisations involved in this sector, and those failures have given a lot of pause for thought amongst federal politicians and regulators alike. We've also got perhaps on the more future-oriented aspect, very significant demands on the higher education system in terms of supporting business, supporting skills development, supporting a growing population that is going to need to be very highly skilled in the future. And so there are a range of quite significant policy tenets running through this framework that has been developed. I think there's also been a fairly clear view about the need to provide clearer protection of students. The protection of students at the moment is a myriad of overlapping legislative protections, practices, policies within the institutions, and so this is providing an overlay to that, which hopefully will give students a clearer, more focused solution in that regard. And certainly on the information front, there's been a very inconsistent range of information, a lack of information in some quarters. As I indicated, I think these are all qualitative. I don't think it's black and white. I don't think that list points fingers at a whole range of universities and other providers and says they haven't been doing these things. Many people have been making valiant attempts and providing high quality provision in many respects, but that's the range of TEXA factors. TEXA regulates an industry, and whilst academia is right to think it's special, nonetheless we're involved in an industry, and there are plenty of examples out there of how you go and regulate an industry, and the TEXA legislation is really no different to that. The group that's been involved, or the various groups that have been involved in trying to refine and negotiate the TEXA legislation have given every emphasis possible to saying we're special and we need a range of checks and balances and we need special recognition of the complex nature of educational services, etc. But at the end of the day, this is regulation of a complex industry and therefore it's complex legislation. It's going to be very complex implementing it as well. So just briefly, we've heard this comment a lot from the Federal Minister and others. TEXA will focus on high-risk providers, allowing high-quality, low-risk providers to operate without unnecessary intrusion, a quote from the explanatory memorandum. So in a sense, that's very much also been encapsulated in the phrase such as light touch on high quality providers. To some extent, some have interpreted that to mean lighter touch than an AUQA audit. I'm not so sure that's the case. I think it'll be a significant amount of process and programs that'll be necessary to ensure internally within the institutions compliance with a complex series of standards being written. On the other hand, I think it's worth it. I'm not sure. I think getting the balance right and having sensible regulatory frameworks and processes will be important, that we're not doing, we're not required to carry out a whole silly range of measures. But on the other hand, I think there's no way of getting around it. If you want to regulate something as complex as higher education, you can't just draw a really long bow and presume it's all working. It may be easier to have done that if we had clear and agreed measures of outcomes, but we don't. And so that may be one for the future. Briefly, the architecture of TEXA. TEXA is a regulatory carve-out model. Constitutionally, the Commonwealth has overridden state power in this regard and relied on its corporation's power to say universities, by and large, universities are trading corporations under the Commonwealth, and therefore the Commonwealth has power to regulate those institutions. It's a carve-out because it's saying it's not regulating everything that these institutions do. It's regulating higher education in respect of those institutions. And so the Commonwealth is regulating activities in higher education. It's leaving untouched state acts that establish these institutions and a whole range of other state legislation and indeed federal legislation that affect the day-to-day operations of a university or a college or another provider. The TEXA regime has been designed to, in a way, respond to the criticism of AUQA that has been made over the years that AUQA didn't have sufficient teeth. And so some have described TEXA as AUQA with teeth. And teeth means a regulatory model with a whole standard series of machinery of criminal and civil provisions that provide control. If you like, that's the backdrop in which the Commonwealth takes control, and within that broad paddock, we hope there will be light touch where light touch is appropriate. But it starts from the point of view of having the necessary tools to regulate. That's a big step from where we've been to date. Certainly it's a big step in a process and practice sense. I'm less convinced It's not been the case under state legislation. There have been state legislative acts for some time that do have fallback provisions of regulation. We've also had some fairly standard provisions that I've just referred to trotted out in the ESOS Act, for example. So there are a range of ways in which these things have already touched the sector. TEXA operates by the minister consulting, appointing commissioners, appointing standards panels, and making standards, referring queries, and not directing TEXA, other than directing the chief executive officer of TEXA in respect of sector-wide issues. So the minister may not direct TEXA in respect of a specific provider, but may make a direction to TEXA in respect of a whole of sector issue. So it's designed as an independent statutory authority, if you like. The first set of standards are going to be made by the minister in the coming months. They won't be made by the standards panel. The standards panel won't be up and running in time, and the standards panel will come along and therefore inherit a reasonably full set of standards, which then need to be further reviewed with potential for change down the track. The TEXA legislation passed the Parliament after a significant negotiation process in the last 8 months. It passed the Parliament, both houses, in the last fortnight, unopposed, unamended, without comment. Basically, one of these things that went through in the middle of the night. So it is therefore in, it is law. I think it's been signed by the Governor-General, so therefore it will take assent within a month. Its regulatory powers start 6 months after that. And it's therefore unlikely to be amended anytime soon, given the political support that it obtained coming in. It came in with bipartisan support. It also has a commission model with five commissioners. They are TEXA. All the employees of the agency are just that, employees, and they support the decision-making and regulatory powers of the Commission, made up of five commissioners. The Minister will appoint a panel independently, and the panel will advise the Minister on standards, and therefore that's been seen as a very important regulatory design principle, that there's a separation of the standards making from the standards enforcing. And I think we would expect that that will occur, that the standards panel will operate independently of TEXA. There may be some feedback loops. All current providers in the states and territories today have been tipped into this scheme. So they're all deemed to be in this scheme as of today, and therefore they'll become regulated from January next year by the regulator. It's a 7-year licence regime whereby all providers are currently taken to have a licence for up to 7 years, and those licences will be renewed on a rolling basis, kicking off from next year on the basis of those that went first in the AUKWA cycle two. So there's a sequencing rolling series of registrations and re-registrations. So therefore we're now in a scheme where TEXA registers organisations, it can deregister organisations in the sense of deregistering the licence to operate in higher education in Australia. It accredits courses with the exception of those that have self-accreditation. The universities fought very hard to preserve their status as self-accrediting organisations, and I would say we've got a compromise on that. Universities have a provision that deals with self-accreditation within the Act, but TEXA, if the circumstances warrant it, can limit the self-accreditation powers of a university. We think that the provisions are likely to be interpreted as the partial limitation and for a limited period of time, but that's all to be explored. Non-universities may apply for self-accreditation and therefore can go to TEXA and demonstrate a good record to do so. The teeth I mentioned, broad civil and criminal provisions, and those sit behind the registration, deregistration and attachment of conditions power that TEXA has. The key issue is that, or key requirement is that once you're in the system and you've got a licence to operate, you have to maintain compliance with all of the threshold standards all the time. Now, TEXA, in knowing whether or not there's been compliance, is going to have to make choices about how it develops systems to know that, how it develops, if you like, self-disclosure regimes, etc. But it certainly has the powers to go and look at anyone, anytime, pretty much. And so we would expect, to the extent that TEXA becomes aware of issues, it will have a fair amount of capacity to go and look at those things. So that's the backdrop. The standards framework is a framework that I think it's reasonable to view as a two-tier framework. Threshold standards, and then what I might call aspirational standards. Now, I use that word tonight. That's not a word that's been used elsewhere. You can find a whole range of adjectives to describe what that next layer up might be best called. I'll tonight refer to it as aspirational standards. This quote from the explanatory memoranda, I think, makes the point that the design of this scheme is one envisaging a high front gate hurdle with a view that if you make the front gate to the system high enough, that should deal with a whole range of issues that you would otherwise face. And therefore, by making the front gate hurdle high enough, the providers in the system are better equipped by definition of getting into the system to go on and provide high quality. And so I think that's important when you think of this framework. The framework is listed in a range of areas. It's listed in the Act. There are draft standards out there for parts of this that haven't yet been declared by the Minister. And again, I've laid it out in a diagram on the screen, which is my own layout responding to that threshold and aspirational model. If you start in the middle at the moment, in the middle with the blue components, the threshold standards, all providers coming into the system have to meet those threshold standards, and those are the ones that we have to meet all the time. The provider registration and provider category and course accreditation standards are in draft. They're on the website, on the TEXA website, as part of the Education Department's website, and will be declared, we believe, shortly in the coming months by the Federal Minister. They are largely, but not precisely, a translation of the national protocols that were set up about 7 or 8 years ago by the then Makeacha ministerial meeting. They were confirmed and backed by all states and territories, so those standards did have, those protocols, not standards, did have a fair weight behind them. The qualification standards are likely to be, almost certainly to be, the AQF, the recently revised AQF, recently launched, and so therefore we're reasonably close to having a first view of the threshold standards. The two above have not been developed. The teaching and learning standards and the research standards are what I'm referring to as aspirational standards. The idea being you get into the system and then all aim to go higher. The teaching and learning has a draft paper out, again on the TEXA website, which is worth reading. It raises all sorts of issues. It certainly raises the question about the need to get on with some of this, given the dearth of actual agreed standards that exist out there. On the other hand, I think the paper suggests it's going to be a bit of a long road as well. But again, I would urge everyone to get involved, because this is going to be worked through. We don't have anything on the research standards at the moment. No descriptors, no place marker or objectives, and so I think that's real work in progress, and is unlikely to be in before regulation starts in January. There's information standards, which I think we interpret as being essentially about the information necessary on which the regulator can do its job, as well as the information practically that is going to be needed to feed the My University's website, which is part of the national system that the government is bringing into place, the various components of that system. And the other standards is a place marker in case the minister decides, or future ministers decide, they want other standards. We did seek to ensure that the other standards clause didn't directly apply to other threshold standards. I think to that extent it's reasonable on the face of the legislation that we're unlikely to have other categories of threshold standard. So that's a quick run through. I won't go through the registration standards, those are there. I'll just point out academic governance number 3 and academic quality integrity number 4. Just for those who might think that these standards and the regulator is not going to make decisions with respect to academic standards, they are. This is not regulation of the corporate activity, this is regulation of a whole range of things inclusive of academic activities, which of course are developed and internally quality assured by institutions. But you can't draw a line down text and say all the academic stuff's over there and it's not going to touch it. So I think we've got a lot of learning to do about how that works. I'll touch on the provider category standards. The protocols had these categories in there. This is a very significant emerging framework for the future of the sector. It needs to be thought of in terms of innovation, of diversity. If you read the articles recently about the proposal to set up a new university in London by breakaway academics, leading academics, that's really in this vein. It's about thinking about what is a university, what is a higher education provider. What we've got here from the draft is in a sense, largely rolling over, although not entirely rolling over, what is in the protocols. There's a draft standard being written, and at the moment, Australia has universities and it has higher education providers, and it has no provider in the two middle categories, the University of Specialisation category and University College category. We also have, we have got overseas universities, Carnegie Mellon to name one. We're probably going to have more coming at us. This is going to be very much the front end of decision making, I expect, for TEXA come the new year. This is going to be difficult territory. I pointed out the research standards haven't been agreed. There's very little in the Act dealing with it at the moment. But writ large down that middle column of research and scholarship is a requirement for a number of these providers to conduct research and scholarship, and those things are not defined, and I expect that will become an issue. So that's a very brief look at what is significant. Course accreditation standards. If an institution is not self-accrediting or self-accrediting only for part of its courses, those that are not self-accrediting have to go to TEXA and be accredited by TEXA. That is already done in most of the state systems, and these are the standards that each course will need to meet. Again, I would just point out, and for universities on re-registration, TEXA will look at these standards and wants to know that all the courses that a university provides meet these standards. If you look at these, again, you can't step away from the heart of academic process. This has got the, you know, the admission front gate, it's got the teaching going on, it's got the learning going on, the assessment and the outcomes, all of which are at the heartland of academic processes. Briefly, three key issues. What is the relationship between the minimum standards and what I've called the aspirational standards? Are they on the same chart? Are they a series of scales with things lower down the ladder and higher up the ladder? Are they totally different? Are they on different wavelengths? Is there a feedback loop? Imagine a decision maker having to decide high quality teaching under things I've just shown you in the threshold standards, not sure goes to the teaching and learning standards because that is a more elaborate exposition of teaching and learning standards. I think those are going to be key questions. Should we be thinking about this as a ratchet effect, that over time you lockstep the system up, that you step up the minimum standards with a view that, you know, over time they move up, and they therefore take on part of the nature of what we've said in a previous generation were higher standards, they become minimum. I also note that the aspirational standards are not attached to enforcement as such, the regulatory threshold standards, and so therefore in a sense the aspirational standards might well be easier for everyone to talk about, perhaps to come to some agreement around, to have greater input in a living, breathing sense. The threshold standards are going to get declared. They're not going to get revised very often, I would imagine. And administrative decision makers are going to have to use them as they are. The second key issue, this really is what is a standard in this framework. Are they really something very specific, or are they broad guides, guidelines, broad patterns of conduct that we would be trying to write down? And I think this is probably going to be the hardest issue for the sector. We've got certainly a range of details written down in the threshold standards that are on their way to being declared. I think the teaching and learning paper is having a major debate about this issue in the teaching and learning space. God knows what we'll see in the research space. So I think that question of, do we see standards as something quite discrete and specific or something broad, will be a major issue. Depending how you answer that question, quite a lot follows from that. Quite hard if you're a regulator to make a whole series of decisions come next January if we've got a whole lot of broad statements. Well, it may not be that hard. They'll make decisions. But the sector has to understand they'll make interpretations to arrive at those decisions. So therefore, from a regulatory point of view, the sector may want greater certainty by having more specific standards. But of course, down that road is a fairly fraught one, because you write down the more detail you go, the more caught up you can become. So that's an issue. I've thrown out a number of dot points on the bottom of this slide to say, well, part of the debate goes on and on and on, but have we ever come out and said what we would regard as way below the minimum standard? Now, what would egregious conduct look like? And the moment you say that, people want to then say, well, fit for purpose is absolutely essential. You've got to look at all the context of the institution. I would ask, is it impossible for the sector to agree on some really lowly conduct, which is way below anyone's threshold, and so it should be? I think the sector needs to confront why it struggles to write some of these things down. Doing so, I think, would be worthwhile in terms of coming to grips with whether we think that a regulator is going to be able to do their job. Tiger Airways on Friday night, big regulatory call. Tiger may never recover from Friday night, and we haven't had one of these since Ansett was called to account. Very interesting, because this is a mix of specific standards and a pattern. Specific standards, quite important, I think, in the public buying of the story. Planes coming in, breaching specific height limits as you come into land at airports. That's out there, and I think people sort of, they can understand, you know, there's a translation of problems into something quantifiable. On the other hand, the regulator said, of course, Tiger had been on a show cause notice since March, but the regulator said, there's a pattern here. We wouldn't expect to see a pattern, not like this, if there were higher quality provision within this organisation. And therefore, the regulator has made a call and said, this looks too much like a systemic problem, we're grounding the airline. Now, what would the equivalent in higher education look like? I guess that's the question. And this is a really good example, because it's so timely. We're not immune to the same kind of decision making. And built into the Act are all sorts of checks and balances, but ultimately, I think if a regulator calls a university's licence, rings the Premier of their state and says, this is now a real issue, that's in the media, again, would they recover from that position? And one of the things that CASA and other regulators try to do is avoid that extreme situation and build in early warning systems. So risk is going to be important. In thinking about those two first questions, I've said maybe we need to think of a frame for the framework, setting standards, applying standards, expert input, and that can have as many subcommittees as we like on the panel, but TECS is going to have to regulate the minimum threshold. On the aspirational side, I think there's a lot more scope for continuous input to the process by the sector. And I think that's important, because at the moment, the teaching and learning paper that's in draft, I think, isn't perhaps as clear as it might be about this distinction. I, for one, don't think that it's going to be tenable to have an expert panel of academic experts advising TECSA, the regulator, on a specific decision that's got to be made. It's just not the way the law will operate. So therefore, you've got to step back on the regulatory side and work out where the sector can have significant input. Finally, and I'll be very brief here, the third key issue, I think, for me, is this system is going to be buffeted by the realities of the industry, of moving to a market-based system in uncapping demand, and as we already know, a sector that is significantly reliant on international students for, among other things, and we should talk about one day the quality of those students and their capacity to contribute in a wide range of ways to local students' education. But the one thing that is often referred to is that the Australian domestic system relies on international students for financial subsidies, economic subsidies. That's one example, because if that dried up within 5 years and the government didn't respond to that and the sector was unable to respond, the standards we're setting now will be looked at in hindsight as being very difficult to meet, I would imagine. Going the other way, if we see new technology, it may be possible to deliver higher quality without more funding in a way that we can't imagine now. The Tiger Airways example. If we have very high profile incidents occurring in our sector, our whole focus around standards are probably going to drift into that corner. And so it's important to think, perhaps before too many regulatory incidents particularly occur, about what kind of breadth of standards we want, so there's more balance. We're not being, if you like, knee-jerked around by in response to key issues. This study, which we've just prepared at the University of Melbourne, and we've put it on our website publicly, is an estimation of that international student premium for each public university in the system today, and a correlation to research up at about 0.9. I think the point is there's across the board significant dependence, and not just in respect of teaching, but these funds channel and fuel, we believe, quality research going on in universities particularly. So we shouldn't assume an unrelated set of variables occurring within the industry in respect of the standards. So in conclusion, I would say we're going to have a new level playing field, a line that goes right through the sector, and any provider that has low standards or can't demonstrate high standards at the front gate is going to be under significant scrutiny and pressure to maintain their licence. I think all providers are going to be under some scrutiny, and that's only right. I think in a system with a lot of checks and balances, there's going to be quite a lot of accountability, including from the regulator. I think the checks and balances that the sector managed to get written into the legislation on its way to being put before the Parliament make this one of the trickiest series of checks and balances for a decision maker within an authority to meet. And so I would say that there are significant checks and balances that will require accountability on both sides. And I think the key is this system needs to be viewed with the point of view of strengthening Australia's higher education system into the future. We need to take at least a medium-term view of that, and looking for ways in which the system can be positive in that effect, not just a punitive series of requirements. Thank you very much.
Michael, thanks very much, Lynn, for your introduction. And ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, I very much appreciate the invitation to be here tonight. And I thought that before I dive into just a couple of background slides and I guess some detail of the argument, I guess, that we've got on this the start of the regulatory process was to take a step back, I guess, and that is that to a certain extent, I think for the right reasons, post-Bradley, the Universities Australia and TAFE Directors Australia have been trying to collaborate on a couple of key issues, mainly to keep some eye to quality, and particularly after a quite disastrous period where we'd seen a great amount of questioning on quality with the implosion of the vet market, private college closures. Melbourne itself was the scene of much strife in that process. And and so it started, I guess, with a joint study that we did in terms of defining something that Bradley didn't, and which was actually what was tertiary. And then we, I guess, went our own ways with universities largely focusing on how to respond to TEXA and the intense negotiations about the legislation. And I think it was a very interesting background tonight that Michael's able to provide. And for us then to look at what was unfortunately a very different process, a process of responding to the National Vet Regulator legislation. And really, I just thought, although I've deliberately not set up tonight as a whinging session, because I hope instead it's something more constructive. While there were quite collaborative meetings and negotiations and consultative forums that the department in Canberra and elsewhere had put together, with the major parties, and albeit for us, we have almost a completely opposite side of the coin in terms of the delivery of by some of our HEPs within the total HEP market is relatively small, but it was very interesting to see by contrast. In terms of the vocational education market, a market where there's now 5,001 RTOs, registered training organisations, became almost a KPI of state authorities on how many they could register each year to make money. And in fact, in many annual reports, in especially Queensland, there was a boast about the number they were able to register in any one year, outpacing all other states. Such was the smart state, and I during that negotiation period, we're all split up into different rooms. The Commonwealth ran their own negotiations with the states and territories, trying to create an intergovernmental agreement. I believe none of which has still been signed by any state or territory, and because of the mixed interests by many industry groups who are also RTOs. It's been a fairly lonely process out there, as we've seen now the start and the referral of powers from July 1. And yet the very reason why the National Vet Regulator was referred and created, which was the concern about quality and standards, is still actually yet to be resolved, and in fact parked by the Commonwealth completely. It was only after an unlikely or good alliance, I must say, between the AEU and ourselves that the Independents and the Greens supported in the Senate, where Senator Evans ultimately agreed that amendments would be passed to the National Vet Regulator, which came into effect on July 1, by October. Which would address those concerns. So I thought I'd just really give you that 3 minutes as a joyous background and really give you a bit of a context of why we think actually it's extremely relevant and will in fact be extremely damaging to the long-term interests of Bradley in terms of a tertiary education sector that might have the term integrated anywhere near it. Unless these issues are resolved. We don't think we've got all the answers, but we actually have put quite a lot of work now over some time into it. And we really thought that from a goal, it was keen, we were really keen to just try to achieve some sort of capacity at least post 2013 to bring a responsible discussion of the Bradley view of tertiary, but it would be reliant on improved architecture and tightening of quality in VET itself. So when I was asked to come and speak tonight, architecture was mentioned, it's not just a great building, but it was also particularly the theme that I hope we can have some agreement on. In terms of some of the broader issues, again, it was really that there was an undertaking at the outset that there would be alignment and parity of principles and process between TEXA and NVR. You'll see why later that becomes quite important. We felt from a sector that delivers about 85-odd% of the delivery in vocational education accredited courses in the marketplace, that a focus on quality and trying to bring transparency via a framework for provider category standards that existed in higher ed, should also cover VET. And I'll touch on, but not concentrate on, the whole issue of texture itself and sort of the other 10%. Lead you through some of our initial thinking, at least in terms of provider categories or provider standards, I should say, which while the states supported, if you like, those being rolled over to the current framework for the interests of getting a deal done, given their performance in VET, we actually question really the basis of that approval process. And that's why we think there's justification for having a closer look at it. In terms of the risk, it's still been quite amazing that the Commonwealth has been a reluctant customer to even see that there is still a risk in vocational education, despite what we've seen. The damage that we've seen in the international student market is not alone for VET, it's across the board. And you only need to travel through the region to see, you know, the continuing concerns that are very hard to extinguish on Australian education itself. In terms of the NVR, in fact, there was a huge argument in the outset over actually the contents of objects within the TEXA legislation. In the NVR legislation, there weren't even any objects. it was either non-existent or weak on risk itself. I think that as we've seen, the TEXA legislation, which was meant to have some alignment, this whole area was really front and centre of a significant part of that bill, now law. So we had an overall concern that VET will once more be seen as lenient on risk and really leaving open for malpractice and the whole troubles that we'd seen on 730 report and elsewhere on fraud and qualifications. We think that there is some justification, and I'm happy to go through some detail, to look at, if you like, provider categories within VET itself. And certainly we think we need help to give structure to multiple RTOs. And I guess that we've seen that to a certain extent, although it's been an evolving game plan, the higher education protocols actually served higher ed well in terms of giving some understanding, both internally and externally, of actually what is up on the market. We've We've gone ahead with a series of papers that are on our website in terms of a, if you like, a case for provider categories. But certainly is that we think that the overarching strategy is that they can assist in the process of managing risk. And that is to say, certain categories of providers would be assessed at a lesser risk because of their capability, track record, and particularly financial capability. We also think that, and I'll come to that, teaching standards also has to be a key component. And still, as we move into the new era of from July 1, having educational purpose is still not a criteria to be a registered vet RTO. The other issue really is that I think we've seen a difficulty by regulators themselves on how to categorise RTOs. It's also been quite litigious, and I think that we're keen really to see that before something like My Skills would be launched, that at an external level, it's all much more transparent than currently what we can achieve with the current arrangements. We've had a go at trying to look at how this might be approached. I'll leave that to the reading because it's quite a detailed 20-odd page paper. But essentially, I do think that we've seen, in terms of trying to approach this from whether you're sitting in China or in India or elsewhere, it's extremely difficult to fathom actually what is the Australian education market. And almost impossible, actually, for students to really understand what they're buying. Certainly, universities have been an advantage because the term university has been quite well retained. The same hasn't been the case for non-universities and TAFE itself. I came across a TAFE in India the other day, which was really quite a remarkable little shopfront. I've got down on the bottom there different processes as well that certainly we've seen across the system. Universities have minimum teaching standards for certain qualifications. The same hasn't been the case within VET, and it just goes to show how basic can be this issue, and yet. We've started with much of this referred to the National Standards Council or the legislation review itself. In terms of the AQTF, we've often been asked, well, you know, we rely on the great AQTF. We've questioned, actually, is it so great? And indeed, is it? Has it been the Achilles heel of the weaknesses that we've seen? We're hoping that the Standards Council see this as a first step to review the system, and we'd hope that the universities themselves would see that this is something that should be supported. For example, we think that the quality of teaching really in VET is central, and And while VET can be distinguished from other educational sectors because it combines three essential elements, a qualification to teach, a qualification in the industry sector concerned, and industry experience, really the requirements outlined in the ATQF in each of these respects is so loose that they've left the system open to abuse, and really it's resulted in the damage to the integrity itself of the sector. For instance, the AQTF states that training and assessment must be conducted by trainers and assessors who, for instance, have the necessary training and assessment competencies as determined by the National Quality Council or its successor, the Standards Council. Indeed, the requirement in reality is that a cert 4 in training and assessment can often be taught by trainers themselves who don't have the full qualification. It's often taught by RTOs that do not deliver any other qualification at that level, and the rigour has also been questioned. I could go on, but it is quite a remarkable story when you look at the holes in this framework. And I think it's also interesting to note that in a review of the TAA qualification, the Innovation and Business Skills Council, the IBSA, proposed to mandate the diploma for the delivery of the Cert 4. Certainly, IBSA reported that they'd been receiving some enormous support from the sector for mandating diploma. However, IBSA will have difficulty in achieving its goal because of the emphasis on competency rather than qualifications. It's been alarming to hear the views regularly expressed and not challenged in public fora that qualifications are not important because VET is only concerned with competence, or what matters is passion, not qualifications. By way of comparison, the draft provider course accreditation standards being developed by the Texter for the higher ed sector require that people who teach must be appropriately qualified to at least one qualification standard level higher than the course being taught, as I mentioned earlier. So I thought that it was really without labouring the point important to signal we've got a problem. We don't think the problem should be parked, and we're really very determined both with the appointment which is imminent of the National Standards Council, and secondly the preparation of the legislation that we'd love to hear wider voices than just TDA in terms of the concerns about going forward, since it's the era going forward, and that we try to have a look closer at the question of should there be categories for the VET sector, what purpose or benefits would they have, and certainly our view is that it's not a public-private divide, it's a quality process that should be adhered to, and I think I'm right in saying 14 of the 38 universities are have RTOs. I think it is something that's within your territory, and hope that there's focus not just on Texter but also in VR. I'll very quickly just run through that. Similarly, also on our website, there's I guess a review that we've looked at, or at least we'd like to see looked at, in terms of to provide standards ultimately in higher ed. We recognise that this is most unlikely in the early stages, but I think that if there is a goal for diversity in the higher education sector and we have quality as a standard, I think it is something that we're keen to see more closely looked at. We've now done a couple of trips over to the States looked at the American Community College system, and currently, in fact, we have a current mission also with L.H. Martin over in the UK. We think that there has been a lot of work done and a lot of benchmarking possible of what's happened in this space, and certainly there's very interesting and different models that have been approached. The overall theme for us has been that to a certain extent, and while universities have been somewhat quarantined from this, politicians on a regular basis say, well, what are we doing about skill shortages? And the other side of the coin of attainment of higher qualifications is actually just what they are and how they're delivered. And certainly over in the States, we found that of the 17 US states now, given it's 4th of July, let's talk about it. I think of the 17 states that have now legislated to allow community colleges to offer degrees, those degrees have been forthcoming, I think, in 180 colleges. And in each case, there's been a series of quite interesting criteria. The colleges had to show that there's a skill shortage or a workforce development plan for the region. In many but not all states, there's an agreement, if you like, between universities and the colleges about what specific courses would be offered. And I think in general terms, many of the degrees that we've seen in TAFE are replicated, where they're much more specialist areas, building vertically in the skill areas are concerned. But interestingly, because there's no research required, so the pricing is different, as it is with the ultimate price to student. So we think that there's some work that I don't think time will allow tonight, but we certainly would recommend, just as Michael's given us some homework to do some bedside reading on text of legislation tonight, so off our website, both from a vet and a higher ed provider categories, we certainly think that there's food for thought as we look at regulation, that certainly quality is looked at, and we can come to some agreement on that basis. And from our point of view of the HEP space, that if you like, the other 10%, much of which is TAFE, is something that we might look at and can work more collaboratively as well. So thanks very much for the opportunity of speaking. Thank you. Cheers.
Michael and Martin, thank you very much for that very comprehensive overview of both TEXA and the VET regulator. Certainly, I think we'll all rush home tonight and read the legislation on TESCA, particularly those who have insomnia. But I think that is a suggestion that we should do, look very seriously at that legislation, and I think particularly what Michael did for the TESCA legislation gave us a broad understanding now to help interpret what is in that legislation. And thank you very much for that. That was very comprehensive. And Martin, thank you very much for the comments that you made on the VET regulator. And also, one of the things I was wondering about is, we entitled this the New Policy Architecture for Tertiary Education. It sounds to me, in terms of, from a policy point of view, in terms of the relationship that's come out of that policy environment between the VET regulator and TESCA, it's more of a jerry-built cowshed than a well-designed architectural design in that. But you might want to comment on a bit more of that. Could I invite you, this is all set up here? We have plenty of time for questions. I think we've scheduled 2:08. I don't know if we'll go quite that long. We'll open it up to the audience. I'll exercise my newfound power as chair tonight to start off with a couple of questions. Particularly one of the things about standards that I can well understand the worry about standards in terms of the analogy with Tiger Airways. If you're 30,000 feet up in the air, you want to know that your pilot is well qualified and trained and that the airplane has been well serviced. But when we get down on the ground in terms of particularly academic standards within higher education, I think I'd have a bit more of a handle on coming to terms with that question if I actually could see some of those standards. And I think that's one of the problems. We're talking about academic standards and academic quality without having them really specified. On the other hand, if we start specifying them too narrowly, particularly in terms of disciplinary-based standards, do we run the risk of standardizing across institutions and stifling diversity and innovation amongst institutions? And the other thing I was wondering about TESCA, it's a huge task that's got before it. What's the danger that this could collapse under its own weight?
Well, thanks, Lynn. I mean, I would agree that you've put very well that balance of issue. We need to see some of these things at least written down, even if we're then going to shoot them down and say that's not appropriate. I think we do need to test below the level of generality and motherhood statements what, particularly what we within the system regard to be the standards, at least in our own institution. One of the difficulties is that because you're moving from particularly on the university end, a self-regulated, self-accrediting model to one that's now more out there and more national. I heard someone describe the TEXA as being the Uber academic board of the sector. But in a sense, the academic boards of our universities really represent the experience base of those within them. They don't necessarily... each institution is unique and different and has its own heritage and its own mission. And so the academic boards of our universities, I think, you know, I sort of see them as sort of curves, sub-curves sitting on a big curve. Maybe that's a bit too linear. Maybe it needs a non-linear model. But in a sense, that the real challenge is getting common understanding between those academic understandings of local standards. And so in simply throwing out, if you like, the egregious list, I think I'm trying to challenge the sector to, you know, we can write some broad statements, we can write some really narrow, some might say narrow-minded, obvious substandard examples, and that's probably what they are. They're not standards, they are examples. And I think we're in search of things that sit in the middle. But I think if we don't come to grips with that, we do have a difficulty having a broader discussion across this whole system. And as Martin rightly says, I mean, this doesn't look neat when you're sitting in Beijing, looking at Australia and wondering, you know, where you go next. And for a student that wants to choose an institution and believes that the institution will deliver a course of a certain kind, are we all confident that that student really knows what they're getting? Are we confident that the representations, the implied representations that are received by that student in Beijing are correct and then are lived up to for the long period of time they'll be here to gain their degree? This is not a try before you buy purchase. It's a major investment for every one of our students in the system, whether they're a HEC student or a international fee-paying or a local fee-paying student. So I think it is incumbent on us to try and step up and put some greater clarification around that. I think the Teaching and Learning Standards paper is a great step forward that's out there at the moment in draft in terms of bringing some of the literature together. What I think it challenges us about is that it is saying that there's not actually a lot of evidence out there at the moment for if you like, outcomes and testing of these things. And so in a sector where we would look for evidence, there's actually not a lot of evidence of the test. So that's a real challenge.
Me indeed. Questions, observations? Yes, please. Andrew?
So we're a lot of third-party accreditation going on in the sector. What role will that have in the TEXA system? Because it strikes me there could be a lot of duplication, that particularly at the faculty level, already going through quite detailed processes with the external organisations, and then maybe going through another similar one with TEXA.
It has no formal role in the process as proposed or as legislated. I think it has significance in being a referral point for decision makers and panel members and
other people involved in this process, including internal, including academic boards and others. And I would say some of those professional accreditation bodies approach their task in a very thorough and broad, including academic-minded way. I think others are less obvious that they have the same frame of mind as an academic quality assurance process. And so in that sense, I mean, the one that I know best, in the legal arena, the accreditation in law is pretty much focused on admission to practice as a solicitor and a barrister, and really a solicitor, in state-based jurisdictions, Victoria, New South Wales, etc. It certainly is focused on some of the national legislation. It gives students an opportunity to look at international norms and frameworks, but that's less its focus. If you look at an internationally oriented law school, and I do think the school we're in this evening is one that's very focused internationally, there's a lot going on in the curriculum and in the student experience in this law school at Melbourne that is not being driven by or would be delivered if all you were doing is delivering to the professional accreditation body's requirements. As important as they are, and as important as they are particularly for skills and workforce in Australia.
Any questions? Yes, please.
Yes, I ask both of you, are there any models overseas from which Tesco has been modelled on, and what's the experience been there? I guess the same applies to the vet area.
Well, in terms of the vet area, it's been largely untested. Although there has been, of course, a better tradition in the UK than I'd say in some other areas and parts of Europe. Certainly, Germany and the UK would be almost singular. In that context, though, we've not seen anywhere, like we've seen in Australia, the proliferation of the registration of RTOs. And, you know, there have been world record standards created in Australia for RTOs. And now, I guess our concern is that because of that process, and unfortunately with in the case of North America, where in the States and in Canada, every state or province has run their own system, and they have not allowed even public funding into most into private at all. So there's been very little comparison. So I guess it's been the problem with, to a certain extent, has been a competition model that's been applied to a sector to think that this will open it up and it will create diversity. I think it certainly has given an edge, but you have to question what's the edge.
Yes, please.
When the announcements of post-Bradley were made in relation to the sector, the desire was to eventually have one regulator for the tertiary sector. Given the issues with both TEXA and ASQA and the standards that sit behind them, do you think that's still achievable? And in our lifetime, or any shorter time frame, and what would be required to achieve that?
Tough question. Good question. I think it is achievable in our lifetime. I would hope it is, because if not, I think we're going to miss out on what this country really needs, which is a much more efficient articulation across the whole span of post-secondary education models. And at the moment, we do have significant blockages and inconsistencies and lack of recognition in both directions. You know, it's actually not just all one-way traffic. I think the government has, as I understand it, it is still contemplating that at some point it would be possible to put these together. I think you can see the pieces of legislation and the agencies, they're both being co-located in Melbourne, and there'll be an attempt, I think, to look very hard at those issues. At the moment, the launch mechanism is really that there'll be cross-referral between the two agencies, and so that each agency can reach an agreement administratively, so that essentially a provider could choose to go to one shop front and have both sets of issues dealt with if they want to straddle both systems. But I think one would assume that hanging on to the name TEXA, tertiary in TEXA, was really a sign that at some point, without suggesting, you know, an imbalance, that there was an attempt to create a full tertiary system. I think what does need to happen is some of the aspects we've talked about tonight around categories. I think there does need to be a greater diversity of those categories, because at the moment, with the sort of polarised models that we've got of 95% of students in the higher education system are sitting in 39 Australian universities. 5% of the higher education students are currently sitting in about 75 non-university providers. And I think while ever we've got that kind of, you know, scale, it's going to the very dominant conceptualisation of certain kinds of providers do certain kinds of education, I think, is a blocker. And so I think by design, this system is trying to be opened up by the government, and that diversity will be important in creating, you know, more experience along the curve, if you like.
I think, Michael, you're a bit more optimistic than I am on that one. That, well, maybe if the two come together in one's lifetime, you're much younger than I am, so maybe that gives you optimism. But it seems to me that, I mean, to bring them together only makes sense if you have a national integrated tertiary education system. It's a bit of a chicken and an egg, but without that, I don't think they will come together, and I don't think there's a great deal of rationale for them to come together. And if I'm reading the situation right, I think we have a real, if not a policy vacuum, a policy environment is actually pulling them apart from what Bradley started to initiate. Now I think we've gone way back in terms of our goal, or what I think should be a goal, of creating a national tertiary education sector. I don't know if, Martin, if you wanted to comment on that.
To this extent, because I take on board those issues, and we talked about, you know, our concerns, I think there are just two quick comments. One is that if you're going to have two distinct sectors under a single approach, I think Denise Bradley herself has talked about respect for each sector, and I do think that one of the interesting states, which is Arizona, which has had a much closer look at actually, well, how do you create such respect? Now, ultimately, in their case, they created an articulation council, and it was compulsory to attend by the public players themselves. They had rotating chairs, and the deans lined up, and so it went through on a vertical basis, and a great deal of progress was achieved. It's taken five or more years. Second comment, and I just think that it will probably take a whole series of approaches quite proactively, because ultimately it's the student, and the student at the moment, I think, often finds that their investment in a qualification can be wasted because a good deal of it's not recognised otherwise, and take, you know, a large number, but certainly not a big number, but a large number of traditional trades, which we always hear politicians talk about before elections. One of the issues, of course, is that the number who go from the trades into Australian management is still single-digit figures. And there's firstly a lack of propensity to go into further training, and secondly there's road blockages after that. New York has had a go at that. They have been offering an extra year to do an associate degree for those who complete a trade. RMIT has started their advanced diploma of advanced trades, I think. Bit of an alliteration there, but anyway, they're having a go at that. I do think that there are different models, but I do think that there is going to be question marks on the investment unless there's some better outcomes or purpose, which might go to that issue you raised.
Lynn, the only sort of adjunct I'd make to that is that I think, whilst I agree sort of from within the system, it seems like it may have gone backwards and there's a long road to bring them together. I think the system, the sector broadly conceived, is going to face significant pressure from the nation to solve the productivity challenge over the next decade or so. And, you know, there's quite a lot of commentary in the papers today about China and what we've done with our minerals boom and what we haven't done with it. And effectively, you fall back on Australia's going to have to be a lot more productive in 10 and 20 and 30 years' time. And so I suspect the sector, which has not been top of mind in Canberra and has not been top of mind certainly in the public mind, is one that is likely to have more of its day in the next decade as productivity becomes, you know, a challenge that only, you know, the whole of the system is capable of solving at the scale that you need that met.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Yeah.
Quick, yes, please.
Yeah, I'll pick up on the VET. It's a question from Martin about competency-based, which you brought up, competency-based and training packages. Lisa Whelehan from here in the higher ed pages earlier in the week was talking about the dual sectors leading a retreat from training packages and competencies by introducing higher ed diplomas and sort of using their place within the higher ed system to do that. I'm interested in any comments you've got from the TAFE point of view about the future of competency-based training packages and how in a tertiary system that might play itself out. And just to tell you where I'm from Victoria University, which is one of the dual sector universities. So interested in your comments.
Well, there's a very significant flight from VET qualifications at the moment, as we know, to higher ed in terms of diploma and advanced diploma because of a unique regulation that Canberra itself created in from Immigration Department in November last year, wherein they're just after having in the same breath conceived the new AQF, where there wasn't going to be categorisation, if you like, within diplomas or so on. So Immigration created a different process for VET versus higher ed in terms of processing. And so it's not surprising that institutions like yourselves have moved as fast as they can by moving courses. I think that's a big issue behind that. But more broadly, the inflexibility of training packages is renowned, in the flight of trying to create some process going back a decade of quality, something we all love. Knowledge, literacy and numeracy and IT skills got dumped in the bin. And you know, it was usually outside training packages that they're looked at. I think that'll be a very big challenge for the system. But I do think that looking at the health sciences and allied health and these sort of areas, it's imperative, as we've seen, that you look beyond a training package. And particularly if a lot of those students are encouraged to take on further quals. And I don't know Mark, if you've got any other comment on that, but it's certainly been our experience that the next generation of training package that's been pronounced is something that we see as an option, hopefully for generational change rather than bedding down just no change.
Yes, please.
Given that we've got over 100,000 students studying offshore, transnational, and Michael, you mentioned that institutions have to comply to all standards all the time, how do you think that's going to affect transnational education?
I think it's going to be a very difficult area in the early days, particularly to work out how you... We're dealing with it in both directions. On my summary of the types of categories, we've got international, we've got overseas university meeting standards of equivalence in Australia, vouched for by their own standards back home. And I think we've got the reverse happening here, where offshore campuses and programs that are being delivered by essentially are the responsibility of an Australian university or provider are going to need to meet these Australian standards. The extent to which local circumstances allow that to be ameliorated, it's hard to say. I think there is an element of fit for purpose conceptualisation of this system, but if we're unable to demonstrate that those students are in quality programs and getting quality outcomes, and that those outcomes are not necessarily the same as outcomes that would occur in Australia, then I think we will have difficulty. One of the things that the sector tried to have amended in the legislation related to third-party provision, because third parties are mainly the way a lot of that is delivered, as well as in Australia, and the government would not let go of that particular formulation, because the formulation is that if a university or an institution engages a third party to deliver those programs or any program, the university or institution must ensure that the third party meets the standards. That's going to be a very difficult thing to assure a council of a university that is occurring. And it, in fact, I suspect it will have an effect in terms of making organisations think twice about entering into contractual third-party arrangements. I think we'll probably see less of that if we can't find efficient mechanisms to get assurance. And I think we'll see greater thought given to the way in which Australian institutions operate overseas. One would hope that by building strong brand Australia in this whole approach, that we're able to go offshore confidently and offer programs. But I think this is really going to affect those programs that were established perhaps on a more of a short-term payback rather than a much longer-term building of quality education in overseas destinations.
Martin?
Only that offshore delivery is a much bigger proportion in VET than it is for inbound, and I don't doubt that how this is applied will be critical, because already we're seeing, particularly in some of the developed markets within China, much more sophisticated co-branded programs being required. And how that's developed, I think, will be key.
Okay, I think I better bring it to a close. Certainly give everybody time to get home and download that legislation. But before we leave, can we thank our two speakers for a very stimulating, comprehensive presentations?